Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, we have another great show dealing with metaphysics and spirituality, science, some elements of what I would call modern physics. And tonight, especially, we're going to be dealing with questions of spirituality and virtue, and how virtue, which is the thought of God in form, think of it that way, is affected by human beings. This is what we're really going to be talking about tonight, although the topic, show topic, is the seventh ray and cooperation and sharing. Some of you may say, oh, I know what that means. Well, that's great. And for the rest of you, what it means is how virtue is created right here in the physical world based upon the thought of God within form in the world around us, the physical world around us. It's a little different than how we feel or how we think. It's about how we interact in a more energetic, physical way. And cooperation and sharing is the perfection of that sort of, we'll say, thought of God when it's in dense energy, the energy that's around all of us right now. Also, electromagnetic energy, which is the energy of my voice as you listen to it. So all of those things have to do with cooperation and sharing. And for a lot of people in the past who have read things that I've written or heard what I've said, this is not unusual. This is not something like, oh, well, I've said it many times. The problem is that cooperation and sharing, as all the virtues, are ideals. They are not the way things actually are at the present time on an average. And for most folks that I have talked to over time, they don't understand that. In other words, people think, well, if we just follow the virtue of God's thought in the seventh ray realm, which is where we are, we will all cooperate and share and everything will be fine. The problem with this is that in order to execute God's thought and form, you need to have not just 1 or 2 or 10% or 50% even of the people involved in it doing it, but you need to have virtually 100% participation. That's where the problem is, you see. In an ideal situation, on a what is known as a sacred planet, Earth is not sacred, where virtue is common. As a matter of fact, it's almost the norm of almost all activity is virtuous. In those situations, there's no problem. There's a consistency, and darkness is minimal. Evil does not exist. And for all intents and purposes, it's really a heaven-like existence. But this is not Earth. Earth is plagued by evil. Darkness is more common than light. And so we have a very, very different living experience. And the goal of cooperation and sharing is just that, is not a reality. And if we try to force that reality onto people who are not prepared, not conscious enough to maintain it, the result is we produce the opposite effect. Instead of producing more of God's thought, we produce the negation of God or evil. This is the scary thing about this process. This is what I'm going to be talking about, because so many folks with good intentions have so many bad outcomes. And the bad outcomes are coming from their lack of wisdom about this subject tonight. Hopefully, I can add some light into that area. And for some of us, at least, it will be a help to, we'll say, raise the veils of illusion that so many people have about a utopian type or a idealistic type of belief, which is mostly fantasy, that the world can be created today to be fully cooperative and sharing. The people who do this sometimes have, at least initially, good intentions. They are easily misled by those with bad intentions, and it allows evil to therefore gain a much stronger foothold, because it allows evil to manipulate and to use things like propaganda and other methods to convince people that, yeah, we should all be cooperating and sharing right now. Everybody should be doing it, you know? So just follow our plan, and we call it communism, or we call it socialism, or we call it Marxism, or we call it fascism. Whatever they want to call it, it's completely shrouded in this nonsense that really it's cooperation and sharing, when in reality it's evil using the fantasy of cooperation and sharing to gain control and power over the, I'll call them the ignorant but well-intentioned folks. And that could be the majority of some of us. I mean, really, in some locales, it's a lot of people that believe this way. And what are you going to do about those folks? Well, you could just try to ignore them, but eventually they can become the majority or close to it and have a tremendous impact by affecting the entire political landscape and bring in these terrible, evil outcomes. So tonight's show is really about hoping that we will circumvent and prevent that from happening here in the United States. And for those of you listening to me from other countries where this may be going on, it might help you to think about how to challenge this and prevent it from happening. In addition, it allows us to become much more, we'll say, open-minded about our own levels of selfishness. Because the reason we can't cooperate and share in totality in today's world is because most people are just plain too selfish to do that. Now, let me give you an example of this. One of these was actually on television last week on the Fox News station. And here's the concept. Many experiments have been attempted, too many to almost count, where shared property has been used by numbers of people outside of a familiar or family circumstance. And the results have been oftentimes fairly disastrous. Let's look at that. What has happened? Well, let's say 4 to 10 or 12, 20 families get together and they decide to divide up a huge pasture land. We'll just use it as an example. And they're going to put their sheep or their goats or whatever out to pasture on the land. And everybody's going to use the land in common. But so that there isn't overgrazing, all the people decide that they will regulate by themselves, by collectively, the amount of animals that use this pasture land for consumption of food. Inevitably, this system quickly breaks down, because outside of the family, and we'll get to the reason the family becomes an important issue, because it has to do with the 7-8 issue. But outside of the family, people don't seem to be able to cooperate and share, not very effectively. And so eventually each person is putting out more and more of their different kinds of animals. And this goes back in time. Now, most of us aren't putting animals out these days, but you can use this model for any kind of shared property or shared materiality. And the result is that some people want to get more, and they originally think they can because not all of the property in the first place is used until gradually is used up. And so they think they have a right to use that which isn't being used. Of course, they get used to using more than their share because they're not sharing and they're not cooperating. And eventually, the process becomes one of destroying the pasture because the pasture becomes overgrazed, the animals end up dead, and disease stricken the remaining animals because there wasn't enough food for them. And eventually get a collapse of that particular economy. We'll call that a specific small-level economy. And the process is seemingly inevitable. No matter how you use this methodology in today's world, because people are intrinsically selfish outside of their families, this inevitably takes place. The less familiar people are, in other words, the more you move distant from the family, the more severe the problem is. Now, and that's been known for a long time. So in other words, if you take people from that are close by neighbors, you might have a greater level of success than if you have people who live miles apart from each other or maybe towns apart. So it gets more severe as there's less familiarity. And a lot of you are saying, well, yeah, that's all true, but how come? And it has to do with the way the seventh ray works. The seventh ray has to do not only with the dimension of time and space we all live in, of course, the etheric physical dimension, but it has to do with our sense of seventh ray energy, which comes from our sexual center. Yeah, and it has to do with the sexual center. It governs propagation, having children and raising children. It also has to do with sexuality. The ability to work with another person to have a meaningful, close, intimate experience together. Meaningful can be for some just a fun time and for others some type of very deep love. But regardless, sexuality is the beginning of how we learn how to cooperate and share. You can see that. It comes from this. Families come from the two together. The sexuality with children builds the foundation of a family. And so everything centers around the sexual center, which causes familiarity. And familiarity is what is, therefore, the place where cooperation and sharing is first founded and works to some level. Now, does cooperation and sharing always work on a familiar level? No. We see families break down all the time, and we see people getting divorced, and we see the children estranged, and on and on. But it's still the most common place that this virtue can be found among humanity in today's world. Now, here's where it gets dicey. Okay, then how come it works somewhat okay with neighbors? I mean, we're not having sex with usually our neighbors, but you know, maybe a few people are. But most of the time, you're not having sex with your neighbors. And most of the time, you're not having children with your neighbors. But your children and their children may be going to school together, may be playing together. Your spouse and their spouse may be very close. And you may be sharing quite a few other things, like you're next door in the backyard. Maybe you have outings, and you have other things that you share together, meals sometimes. You may look after each other's families at times. So that's where the familiarity starts to be shared to some extent, and that's why there is some better cooperation and sharing among people who live close to each other than among people who live more distant. So it's an interesting thought that here we have the virtue, which is the most, we'll say, complicated and difficult virtue to create for people who are physically alive. Now you say, well, why is that true? Because when you're not physically alive, wouldn't it be harder because you don't have physical senses anymore? You know, well, you don't have illusion anymore either. Your physical senses are gone, that's true, but your illusion is gone. And cooperation and sharing is not as necessary. So actually, when you go to the astral or mental worlds, cooperation and sharing is actually sometimes more prevalent in at least some of the more virtuous parts of those worlds. But it doesn't seem to make that much difference anymore because people don't need it so much. And it's kind of optional. Whereas in the physical world, it's hard to survive without it. I mean, literally, the whole next generation would die off if there was virtually no cooperation and sharing, because all families would fail, and we wouldn't have any more generation. The children would become victims of the lack of cooperation and sharing. So it's very critical here, not so critical in a world where birth and growth of children is not the critical element of life. And the reason it's so critical here in the physical world is because it's part of the seventh ray and part of the seventh dimension that we learn this. And we learn it in the most difficult of avenues to do it in while we're physically alive. Souls are after this knowledge and understanding because without it, they can't complete their journey of understanding how to, well, understanding God and understanding how to grow more of God, which is what they're about. And so they have to live in this most difficult place. Also, life can only start by choice of God. It can only start in the etheric physical world. It cannot start in the astral or mental world. So if you want to create new life, you got to do it right here. And the reason for that is to encourage souls and us, kind of pilgrims of souls, to come here, because it's such a really difficult process. And so the big deal is that you get to create life. And if you think about it, what is one of the major, we'll say, pushes of adults is to have children and to have sex. Those two things become a really strong urge. And it's a desire, yes, it has an astral component, but it's more than that. It's more than just a desire. I would put it into the realm of need for some people. Now, that being the case, here we have a strong need to have children by some people and sex by some people and put together by a lot of people. Then cooperation and sharing is going to be the hallmark of the best way to achieve those things, those two needs. Problem is that it's also extremely difficult to cooperate and share with others when we're so illusioned, we're so selfish, that means, in this realm. And therefore, because of our selfishness or illusion, the same word basically, we fail more often than we succeed. That's why it's more dark than light about this subject tonight. In this world, you know, on Earth. There are some places this is absolutely not true. So I don't want you to think the whole universe is just screwed up this way. No, Earth is a real enigma. It means it has great problems that are built into its design. We're trying to overcome evil, and so it's built to invite evil in, which is kind of a cuckoo idea, if you ask me, but, you know, it's not so cuckoo. If you're going to try to overcome the worst evil, or the worst kinds of evil, then you need some experiments, some laboratories, to go ahead and do it in and see how well you can do it at. Earth is one of those experiments. And no, you didn't pick the wrong card to get here, and somebody didn't assign you the task. We chose it as souls. I know it's hard to believe. But on a conscious level, a long time ago, for most people, we came here and chose to be here and incarnate here so that we could contribute this tremendous contribution to the universe on a planet as primitive and difficult as Earth is. Seventh ray is the bottom line of that problem. And cooperation and sharing is where many of us are failing to achieve it. Now, how does this leave evil with great advantage? Since cooperation and sharing is such a tremendously important sport and virtue, why is it when we try to be too zealous about getting it, you know, like, oh, yeah, we're all going to do cooperation and sharing from now on, and that's the way it's going to be. Why is it when we try to force this on ourselves, and more importantly, even on others, does it oftentimes lead to evil? Well, you know, in most of the utopian societies, particularly the ones that are in the experiments that many people are familiar with here in the United States and in Great Britain and other places that took place during the 19th century, those places turned dark. Some of them became outright evil. In recent times, some cultish types of experiments have been done in the last century, in the 20th century, to turn out the same way. Why is this so when the people were so almost fanatical about wanting to be virtuous and now they turn out being dark or worse? What is there that is so so terribly destructive about wanting to do that at an early time? And the best way I can describe it is by describing a thing called spiritual ambition. What the heck is that? Well, for people who aren't necessarily just doing trying cooperation and sharing by forcing us, for people who are even spiritually, we'll say, disciplining themselves, if you become too ambitious at it, you actually can fall victim to the dark side, even to evil. Because the results are like this. Your real purpose is not to become closer to God, but to have power over others, including yourself sometimes, some parts of yourself, and to control rather than, including yourself, rather than to love God and to be as God is, which is actually non-controlling, uncontrolling, open-minded, and not attempting to force anyone to do anything. You see the problem. The contradiction comes in between a fight between the personality and the soul. And it's so seductive. Our personalities are pretty smart at doing this, too. To believe, well, I'm just trying to do good for everybody. So I'm going to force everyone to share. I'm going to force everyone to have health care the way I think health care should be. I'm going to force everybody to live my dream, whatever that may be. Force everybody to go to the schools that I think are good for them. Learn the things that I think are learnable for them, understandable to them. You see, when we get into that thought process, we may think we're doing good because our personality wants us to think that because it wants to be in control. It enjoys the control. But it really is a very dark path, one that leads to evil. It leads to things like Marxist, communist notions. It leads to people camping out on Wall Street because they don't want people to have more money than they do, or more money than other people do. They want everybody to cooperate and share now, the way they've decided it's going to be done, of course. And they want it done now. Not tomorrow, not next year, but right now. This sort of, we'll call it redistribution of energy and time, which is money as well, is really nothing more than the old shell game of the personality hiding itself and trying to act as though it's a soul when it's not, and acting against the interests of the soul and of God. It's ungodly. But it appears to those participating, and to maybe some people who aren't yet participating but who may be suckered in by the arguments, that it's just cooperation and sharing, and that's a good thing. Isn't it a good thing to cooperate and share? That's a virtue. Why can't we all do it? And the reason we can't is because that virtue can only be created on an individual level. Because human beings do not have collective souls. They have individual souls. That's the way God made us. And if we ignore that fact, then we ignore what God is. God is a being. a being that collectively is all life, but God is also an individual, and God wants all life to eventually have both qualities. God does not want all life to become some cooperative group experience, nor does God want all life to become so mired in individuality as to ignore that cooperation and sharing is important, but from the level of giving by the individual to others in wisdom instead of being forced to give by the group onto the individuals, or the government, if you want to call it that, if you're interested in the socialistic aspects. So that's the point. It's that bottom line that escapes so many people these days. And you may ask, well, if they discovered this in the 19th century with all these utopian societies, and they discovered it in the 18th century by people living in England with pastures in New England when they came over here in the same kind of concept, and then they discovered it in the 15th and 16th centuries in more medievally constructed kinds of environments. They weren't medieval at the time, of course, but they were coming out of it, and they didn't have anywhere near the level of cooperation and sharing to try to achieve these kinds of results. They even tried it in monasteries, and it didn't work. So the process has gone back in time all the way, thousands of years, and actually, if you go back to prehistory, hundreds of thousands of years, to, I don't know, almost an unlimited number of experiments that have dismally failed. Because in order for human beings to achieve cooperation and sharing, they need to be in what is called the sixth root race. Sixth. Those of you who know something about ageless wisdom will say, well, that's not going to be for like 1,000 years, maybe, or 500, it depends. Yep, that's right. That's right. Why is that true? What is the sixth root race? What is that thing? Sounds like some kind of plant or something. Roots are growing. It has to do with the nature of what that race is going to develop in itself. It's going to develop as its foundation its heart chakra. It's going to be a wise, giving race that will finally, when it is in physical form, here in physical life, be able to cooperate and share by the majority of folks who are physically alive. Not everybody, but the majority will be able to do that. And that could be 500 years from now. But it's a possibility. But we're not going to get there if we do this spiritually ambitious kind of behaviors today, because they're going to mess up the whole world to the point where we're never going to make it to that other, more advanced race. So if we continue to make these crazy mistakes that it's okay to force people to cooperate and share because it's for the greater good, you see, it's going to be for no good, and only evil will be victorious. There won't be a sixth root race. Now, when does it become ubiquitous? In other words, everybody becomes cooperative and sharing when they're born in the physical world. That's not until the seventh root race. That's thousands of years from now. That's when it's expected to happen. So we've got a ways to go expecting people to be thousands of years ahead of themselves in development. It's just ridiculous. It'd be like asking a 2-year-old to get out and drive cars and be able to earn a living. And I mean, it's that ridiculous of an assumption or an expectation. So we've got to be much more tolerant and a lot less ambitious about our expectations. Now, for the rest of the show tonight, I'm going to talk about the realistic expectations of cooperation and sharing, how we can really make improvements in it, and how we can stop going down these crazy roads of usually the young and unwise. Sometimes they're the same, but sometimes they're not. Sometimes old folks are very unwise too, but it's more likely a disease, we'll call it, of young people who reach a state of sexual maturity and who want to jump way ahead into this kind of socialistic design model of controlling the power over others to have a utopian approach to life. I can remember myself, I was taking philosophy of religion courses, philosophy of science, philosophy in general, and certain other psychology courses back in the beginning days of my college career, and actually entertaining thoughts about this model, this thought. And I actually sat in into some pretty radical meetings of people in the Chicagoland area who were oppressed. These are mostly people of color who were oppressed, and some were very, very radical. I was one of the few white folk around. As a matter of fact, the school I was going to was a black college, so it's kind of a weird thing. I was one of the token white students. And I kind of got in the grips of it for, 6 months to a year. And then I began to see that the expectations of the people, besides turning towards violence and social unrest and disorder, and definitely communism, was off the mark. I began to realize that these folks were not going to have the utopian society, they were going to have a totalitarian society, with the people that I was involved with trying to be the ones in power. I stepped aside from that and moved into a different direction. But so many of the people that I knew then did not do that. Now, this was in the 60s, the late 60s, or later 60s, and mid to late 60s, we'll call it. And it was a tremendous disappointment to me to realize that I had supported something that, in a short order, I realized was the wrong thing to be doing. But I also felt very badly for the people that were still caught up in it, because I could see that they were still just as fervent about it, sometimes more so, and I could see where it was heading for them, and it wasn't going to be a good thing. And it didn't turn out to be good for the people who stayed with them. So the interesting part about this is that some of us have gone through this, and it usually happens in your late teens, early 20s, when you're not... You got a lot of knowledge sometimes if you've been going to school, whatever, and not a heck of a lot of wisdom. And you get confused. I got confused between the question of control and power versus love and God. I really thought, I was doing the godly thing. Get everybody to love each other. Kill them if they don't. What the hell? Okay. So this also plays into spiritual ambition, because sometimes people who get into spiritual ambition become fanatics, and then they become cultists, and they get into the control and power rather than into God. God is not control and power. That's the antithesis. That's evil. Evil is what seeks power and control. And so does the personality. It's not necessarily evil, but it can turn into evil. Personality does it just because it's part of us that doesn't have a really high function. It just has an important one to keep us alive, especially when we're younger. Eventually, we're supposed to supplant it with a more soul nature, and the personality is supposed to become pliant and give in. Well, that only happens on rare occasions still, at least in the physical world. For a lot of people, when they go on to the astral world, it's a success. But it's here where it really counts, and it's here where we've got to make a change, make a stand against this kind of problem. I want you to think about that. We're going to go to break here in another minute or so. And I want you to think about that, because for the rest of the show, I want to talk about some practical alternatives to these difficulties that I've mentioned in this first part, where I usually define the nature of things, the problem we're talking about, and what kinds of solutions we can come up with that aren't going to lead us into a darkness and evil and a destroyed world in the process. And I want all of us to be able to become members of that sixth and seventh races of human beings. And we can. We really can. It's just a matter of living better now so that we're preparing to become better at cooperation and sharing. At some time in the future, when it can be of virtually second nature and not such a dilemma that every day is a struggle, every day is a fight internally for each of us or for most of us. So think about that. And at this point, what we'll do is we'll take a break, and then we'll come back in about 2 minutes and 30 seconds from right now.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. M-A-C-F-L-O-U-E-R.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. I hope many of you are enjoying so far what we've been talking about, which is the seventh ray and cooperation and sharing. Now, this is a subject that it has a lot of practical sides to it. I talk about mostly the conceptual and theoretical issues, as I usually do in the first part of the show. I don't like carrying through too much more on that in that way, because it's hard. It's a lot of mental strength to maintain that for 2 hours. And I know that for most people, it's just like, it's Friday night. I want to chill out. So I'm going to get into the practical issues. Occasionally, I'll mention some other conceptual things that will fill in blanks and other things I didn't quite cover in the first part. But let's talk about the practical side of this. The practical side has to do with economy. The seventh ray is the ray of economy. Now, what does that mean? It means it is the ray that gives us a sense of, because the seventh ray has to do with sense. Remember, it is the sexual center, but it has a lot to do with other things besides just sex. It gives us a sense of how much we give with how much we take. Now, how does it do that in a sexual sense? Well, again, I don't want to get too conceptual, but we got to understand that part. When you're having a sexual encounter, the energy that you're moving towards the other person, you've got to change to be stimulating to them. And this is kind of a, it's too complicated of a subject for me to give you a lot of explanation. But you've got to be able to do that in order to keep them interested, and vice versa towards you. Okay? And you've got to really kind of be in their shoes. So you've got to have some empathy, and you've got to have some understanding of who and what they're like, and appreciate them for what they are. Because if you don't like them, it's going to be pretty hard to do. You can do it if you don't like them, but it's not going to be very as effective. And so this is the beginning of economy. It sounds weird, but you know, most people think of economy as like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go out to work. Now I'm going to go have sex. But sex is the foundation of economy. It is the way that we gain a proportion of something outside of ourselves that we're going to do in real time as an exchange with someone else. It's a lot different than having a job where you're working for somebody else, but in many ways, it's the foundation of how we may learn how to do this. Now, before we learn the sexual side of it, we learn the side which also has to do with propagation and learning how to raise children and how learning how to be a child being raised. These things also give us a sense of proportion early in life that gives us an understanding of what economy is. Economy means that some things are more important than others. Those things that we value have a higher value to us and maybe to others, and those things that we don't are lower. And therefore, those, some things have greater value to some people in a material sense, but well, sometimes it's not non-material as well, because you can have economies that are not just based upon material things. So ultimately, you start learning economy as soon as you're being, as soon as you're born and being raised. Some things you like better, some things your parents like better, and there's an exchange and there's a sense of proportion that's being developed through, amazingly, the sexual center. And the sexual center does that part for a long time, you know, for most people, for 12 to 14 years before the sexual center becomes sex. It's first proportion based upon being part of a family, being raised, being, we'll say, helped become an adult over time. So this is the foundation, and when we are developing ourselves into this economical vein, we are starting to learn the value of many different things in the environment around us. Values determine a kind of, we'll say, propensity for a lifestyle that we will eventually choose. Our personality will be very much involved in that because it will eventually call it a vocation. But in the immediate sense for children, it really has more to do with the attention and love and the graces of our parents, and maybe if we're brought in a religious environment, or at least spiritual, of God. So all these things become important elements to us in the sense of economy. And we want to conserve those things that are of high value and are willing to usually expend those things which we value less. Okay? This is the way that an economy works. Each individual has that as part of their nature. And every individual is unique in the way that they relate to the bigger economy around them. So each individual is valuing some things more than others. They're willing to expend more on some things more than others in time and energy, and when that's compressed down, it becomes money. And they are willing to exchange with others based upon the difference between their values and the others' values. If everybody had the same values, you would not have an economy. Why? Because there couldn't be an exchange, because there'd be no difference. It'd be like trying to have sex between yourself and yourself. I mean, you can maybe do that. We, of course, know that as masturbation. But the point is that it's not the same experience anymore. And so you lose this proportional issue, which is so important to the question of economy. Now, what is wrong, then, on a practical side, when people don't want there to be a difference in the values of people? Everybody should have the same amount of everything. Everybody should have the same experiences, the same rewards, the same losses, the same everything. You know, why is that not okay? Well, the reason it isn't okay is because in the beginning of the very process of developing that, you lose the proportional issue and the value structure, and so the economy fails. By definition alone, you can't have an economy based upon that, because it won't survive unless you give up the proportional nature and there's no longer a need to, we'll say, develop that individuality within each person. Now, you could say, well, that sounds impossible because that wouldn't be the nature of a human being. You're right. In today's world, and in the race that we exist in, we don't understand anything other than that. That's us. That's who we are. Can we change? Yes. If we become more, a great deal more like the next kingdom, our soul kingdom, if we act as our soul, souls do not act on that same basis. They live for the benefit of all others. They are individual in their creations, but they are not individual in their values. So there's a problem in the differences between souls and human beings right now. Human beings have individual values. Souls have a collective value. And so they have a different style of living. That's why, as we advance through our races and become more and more soul-like, and some of us actually move into the soul kingdom, that's the fifth kingdom instead of the human kingdom, which is the fourth. As that happens, we lose this individuality of values. We gain a collectiveness of values, but lose the individuality of values. And at the same time, we don't lose our individuality because we gain a new kind of creativity, not based on values, that has to do with material things, but based upon ways of creating more of God. We become more like our soul and the angel that is associated with our soul than we are like a human being. But we aren't there yet, and that's just a fact. It would be no different than asking that ants or maybe mice suddenly start developing the ability to build churches and collectively go and worship God. That's about what we're asking for if we're asking for us to have values that no longer involve material life. And material is not just the physical. I'm talking about material in the sense of astral and mental as well. Those are forms as well. And if you give them up, you don't become fixated by them anymore, but you have to be a different being to live in a new kind of life. And life takes on a different meaning, a much wider, bigger meaning. But it isn't about the things around us, and it doesn't have to do with the needing of those things any longer. Once you've mastered these lower realms, you can create any material thing you need at will. And so there's no longer a need to have an economy about material things and the values associated with them. So the exchange of things, materiality, and energy becomes a thing of the past. And for those of you who are curious enough about this subject, there still exists sexuality, but the sexuality becomes the experience of the other person rather than yourself. That is so hard to understand that I don't even know how to describe it, except I have experienced it, so I can explain it in a slight sense. And that is that the experience for most human beings is their own experience of sexuality. Yes, they're giving to others in ways that those others need to have and receive, but they still experience it from their own perspective because it's their values that are controlling it. But at some point, we become souls, and souls have sex for the other person's feelings and the other person's experience, not for their own. They still have it with only one other. Monogamy is not vacant at all. It's the opposite. It's always monogamous. But it's from 180 degrees from where we are. So it's a different perspective and a different experience from that perspective. And in many ways, you could actually claim it also is far less material. But I don't want to get any deeper into that subject. That could be a whole show, right? So we don't want to go too far with that. Okay, so let's go back to this issue now about the values and that we're, you know, we're trying to make ourselves to become a little bit less selfish, less illusioned. We want to cooperate and share more, but we still have this nature of wanting to be individuals about the ways that we're going to create in the material world and have material things. And we want to have an economy. And even when it comes to how we exchange feelings with each other, it's still based more upon our feelings than the feelings of others, not vice versa. So that's where it becomes critical. Now you could say, well, is there ever a time when that isn't true? Yes, among families, still, I'll go back to the family thing, we sometimes reach a point where this is true, where people and families actually care more about the other members having certain things more than themselves, and they also care about how other people feel sometimes more than themselves. But they don't necessarily experience the realm of their feelings more than themselves. That's the soul thing. They don't necessarily feel that, but at least they get to the semi there, sort of getting there. So that's the good part. And what's the rest of it, though? Well, outside of families, you don't almost see any of this sort of thing, except in some kinds of spiritual group situations where people function, when they're functioning spiritually, in that realm. And that could be a religious type of spiritual group or a non-religious type of spiritual group, organized, I'm saying. Oh, it doesn't matter. But if you reach that point, that's another wonderful thing. That's a great way of experiencing each other, et cetera. And you're living more as a soul. For most people, though, the practical side of this is this, that most of us are living our lives as individual and with individual values that control our material existence and our feeling existence and thought existence to the point where these things have a delineation and value that we accept as being who we are. And we accept that other people have differences from us so we can exchange with them and develop an economy together. That's the foundation of our society here in the United States, and it supplanted the societies in Europe and other places in the world before the United States that used a totally, we'll say, primitive system, more primitive, where the familiar model was extended into the society itself, and nobody except the quote-unquote elite had the ability to decide who got what when. And that was a monarchical society with most of the values established by the elite, and the rest of the folk were basically serfs to do whatever they wanted them to do with. Even in more modern societies like England, up until this last century, they still had a predominance of that in it. They did not have a true capitalism society that was free market-based. They had capitalism, but it was mostly for the well-to-do and elite. And the rest of their society was pretty much left alone. not given the ability to have individual values that could be traded very effectively. So they literally worked for very low wages or had hand-to-mouth businesses but couldn't move up the ladder. The United States and the people who created the United States and some other countries after the United States that built free market systems recognized the great founders of the United States and the other countries that followed, recognized the individuality of values in humans as being coming from God. God said, this is the way a human being will be until it becomes a higher being, a soul. And while it's a human being, these are the ways that human beings will be able to function. They will clamor for, they will seek to cooperate and share, but for the most part, they will actually be relatively selfish and create a thing called free market economies that allow themselves to exchange with others. So they gradually develop cooperation and sharing into and past their early adult life. And this will be the way that in an interim period for most of the fifth race, the remainder of the fifth race, that people will develop. It's a good thing. It's not a bad thing. Now, are there problems with that system? Yes, because free markets are excellent provided they're free. But when you have systems, there's always those who want to take advantage of it. Now, I told you about the people who want to obviously create socialistic and communist societies, but then there's the others who want to create oppressive, I think of it as sort of fascistic, but it's really not social. It's not socialism. They want to control capitalism through monopoly. The same problem. It's no different. It's just like it's like putting a different face on the same problem. They want to be in power and control of the economy instead of allowing it to be free market. That is not the design of the system that is supposed to be taking place in the United States and other countries that pattern themselves after it. There's supposed to be a free market, and there are laws against monopolies. Sometimes they are abused. When they are abused, the people who abuse them should be considered criminals and prevented from further functioning in that economy. Now, sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't, and we're still working it out. But it's still better than having a system where the government controls everything, because then it's no better, and it's a lot worse, actually, because it has more power and control than any individual robber baron who is monopolistically controlling this segment of the economy. Because the government controls all segments eventually. Even if it's only socialism and not communism, it controls enough so that it controls everything. So this is the ultimate issue. This is the problem that we face, is to awaken ourselves to the reality of who we really are and to encourage the benefits of gaining wisdom to cooperate and share while we are still too selfish to function completely in that vein, and instead develop our values and create economies among each other that promotes a healthy way for people to continue to develop themselves. Because in free markets, the people are able to become self-created. And that's one of God's edicts. Life is to be self-created. It is the forefathers' first concern when they decided to create our country, is that each person is self-created. And so this was the premise of how they came up with a free market system. And they didn't want to legislate a free market system, because if any legislation of free markets, other than having laws against monopolies and laws to protect patents and certain other things, you know, intellectual property, if you don't have those things, then you have criminality. But they didn't want to legislate that you have to have a free market, because their concern was that that would lead to another form of some kind of fascistic, power-grabbing, controlling government. And they were more afraid of government than anything else, and it was a good thing. They were. because they had experience with it in other countries, and they saw how it, on a monarchical standard, destroyed the free will of people, and instead of having self-creation, they had destruction of self, and they wanted to prevent that. And this is amazing, because it's from that one concept, and everybody says, well, there was no religion. This is about as religious as you can get, in a sense. They had the religion of self-creation, the religion of God itself being a being that wants all life to create itself, and they got it. Now, some people say, well, they may have just thought some philosophy, and it wasn't really very spiritual. I think it was highly spiritual. I think these 56 guys that came together and said, hey, let's get it all together and figure it out, they got it figured out. They were brilliant, brilliant spiritually developed people. And they had different views. Some had more one way, more another way. But collectively, they got it right. And what's happening today is we're getting it wrong. The practical side of this is that if we continue down the path that we're presently going, we're moving back to the monarchical side of things, moving back to socialism, collectivism. We're losing the idea that it is through the individual that we find God, not through the collective. We eventually find God through the collective, too, by becoming souls. But we're too far away from doing that now. So we've got to stick with what we can do best, which is this individual thing. Eventually, souls are very individual while they're extremely collective at the same time. They can get it balanced. They have a balance between spirit and energy in them. That's beautiful. We are tremendously imbalanced, very little spirit and a huge amount of energy. So we're not in the right place. Those of you who have read Light Said Meaning knows that the definition of a soul is that, right? You read chapter 6? It says the first paragraph, a soul is a being that has equal amounts of energy and spirit. Wow. That's just the first definition of a soul. But to most people, that doesn't mean anything. And even if it meant something, getting there is long way off, hundreds of lifetimes. That's why it's so far in the future. All right, so what else can we do? Well, since the values are a critical measure here, I'll tell you what. I'll keep that thought. I just want to mention a couple of things. I'll let you cool off a little here. I usually do that about this time in the show. And we'll come back to how we can improve on our values, so that we can make this whole thing work out better. And I'm going to give you some practical suggestions for that. But I just wanted to make a couple of comments here. Some of you may know that I'm writing again. Yes, I'm going to be writing again the next couple of years and produce some books out there. Because there's been some clamor for that, and I'm glad that you guys are saying, hey, we want to read something too. We talk great on the radio, but we want more to read. And Light Said Meaning could be read, but you know, it's like it's a career move. Right? How many years are we to spend reading that book? So you want some books that are more specific, less deep, maybe more practical. Okay, you can do that. No problem. One of the books I'm thinking about is a children's book that deals with spirituality and God on a level where kids can understand it. I mean, young kids. That is not specifically religious, but is highly spiritual, and explains how God exists and why they can understand what God is here for, and that they have a relationship with this being. So it's it'll have a lot of pictures in it, and it'll definitely be for young children. That's one of the things. So anyway, I've got a number of other ideas. And if you are interested, you can sponsor a book. There's several different ways to do it. You can do it as a group. You can do it as an individual. If you are interested in doing this, you can contact me or Niles at Why Life is one way to do it. You can contact Angels Wisdom Distributors, who probably will be involved eventually in the publishing, or at least in finding a publisher, not doing the publishing. So all of this is going to be handled by me and others. So you can do that and just let me know if you are interested. Also, I wanted to make mention that if you haven't tried it, think about giving Bai Chi Jizik a chance. You can find out more by going to BaiJizik.com. You can call 602-431-5762, and somebody will talk to you about it. You can get two different sizes, a 30-count or 100-count bottle. And it is a product that is one of the best pain relievers that you can possibly use. It's not cheap, but it works great. There are no side effects that I can tell you about. And it just works amazingly well. It moves the energy away from the place where it's collectively either too much or too little, which causes part of our nervous system and etheric nervous system to register it as pain. Well, it balances the energy in our system from one center to another and removes the necessity of the pain. And then you just don't feel it anymore. And within an hour or two, it's gone in most cases. And if it's a severe pain, within a day or two, it can be gone. Now, that's a pretty amazing product. And you just have to use it accordingly. Some people take too little. Some people don't take it often enough. So there's problems. If you're going to use it, you need to use it in the way it was meant to be used. Also, it doesn't work that great with narcotics, because narcotics try to deaden the energies, the demonic energies that are controlling the system, and this product tries to get them to wake up. So you're kind of like fighting yourself. You can take it with things like, you know, over-the-counter kinds of pain relievers that are non-narcotic. And sometimes the two will work together. But narcotics are not a good thing for it. If you are addicted to a narcotic, don't expect this to work for you at all. You've got to get off the narcotic and be not addicted to it anymore for the Jizik to work for you. Okay, so enough of that. Now let's get back to the question of how do we improve the values. You see, obviously, this system is based upon individual values. The quality of the values that people have controls the quality of the economy. Can you see that from what I said earlier? If my values are for going out and getting drunk and raking up things and being a loudmouth and kind of a despicable character, that's my value of what I want. And if your value is that you sell booze and you sell drugs and you sell things that I can use to break things up with, then we can do an economical exchange. But the values that you have, the values that I have, are not very good values. You see. Why aren't they good? Because they are values that do not support the enlightenment of the forms around us. They don't have virtue in them. And they never get us to cooperate and share, therefore. Because cooperation and sharing is the ultimate value that each of us needs to get to. And what our values are doing is to destroy cooperation and sharing in the long run. And in the short run, to destroy even any semblance of any kind of light form around us. So it's the values that are the problem, that the reason we're not moving ahead fast enough is that problem. So if you want to improve your level of cooperation and sharing and have a kind of infectiously involve others, you need to improve your values and exchange with people only at your level or higher of values, so that you encourage the economy around you to continue to gain in light. And at the same time, therefore, to build more cooperation and sharing in the long run. But that's a very long period of time. It's not going to be immediate. This is a big deal. Now, looking at it from the familiar side, this is the main reason our families are falling apart. Families work on the same basis, but they're even more infected by bad values quicker, and it destroys not only the sense of economy within the family, but it destroys the family itself very quickly if the values of the people in the family have these low levels to them, if people are in drugs in the family, if they're using, abusing any substances, if they're doing things that are ugly and destructive in a multitude of other ways, if they're having, as an example, extramarital affairs, or if they're being indiscriminate intersexuality in other ways, if they're also not showing caring, even at the most basic levels, and if they're stealing or doing other things to others outside of just between themselves, they start destroying the foundation of their economy among themselves, because the values that they're using are so dark that they're supplanting the gradual cooperation and sharing that they have with just pure selfishness. Eventually, they become selfish among each other, not just with those outside of the family. This is how the family is destroyed. And it's happening time and time again. It's over and over again this is going on. And so if we want to improve the families, we need to improve the values of the people in the families. And that means we've got to have really good education starting from the family level. And the best education is by example. So the parents and older siblings need to be great examples for the younger people. Remember, this whole thing starts, the values and everything else, starts by being brought up, being raised in the family. You see, those doing the raising get certain experiences in the process, and those being raised. And so this is the foundation of the family unit. Now, outside of the family, the educational system needs to support the values of the family system. You never want to send your children into a school system with values that are lower than the family system. Never. If your school system has lower values than your family system, it will eventually erode your family system. So I know that's a bitter pill for some people, because not everybody lives in an area where they can choose the schools that their children go to. Then move. Now, Arizona, I'm in Arizona. Arizona has all these charter schools. We have a free system here. Texas does. There's a lot of other states. And if you're in a system, New York is notorious for not having freedom, and neither is Washington, D.C. If you're in a system that doesn't have it, maybe it's time to consider either changing it if you can or leaving. And certainly, when enough people leave, those areas will not have much of an economy. We're going to get to the numerical value in a few minutes. And this will hurt them, and they may change their ways. But in the meantime, for your own sake and your family's sake, you can't have outside schools or religious institutions or social institutions that have values lower than your family. That's an absolute. And for a lot of people, they have compromises because they got to send their kids somewhere, they got to go out and work, and there's nobody home. And there's so many issues. But believe me, this is one that you can't compromise on, because it'll come back to destroy you and your children. Your family will be destroyed. It may take a long time. It may take years. Economies grow and destruct on a relatively slow level of time. I mean, usually months to years. But they do eventually fall apart. And when they do, it takes an equally or greater longer period of time to rebuild them. So you don't want to go down that path, because it's such a slow and arduous one to recover from. So hopefully this is a word to the wise, I hope. The other thing is, if you are having this problem, talk to other people, your neighbors. Get involved with the school board if there is such a thing. Do what you can if you can't leave and you can't find another school. And if they don't allow homeschooling, and you can't homeschool your own children because you're not available. There's a lot of options, though. And you may find someone else who can homeschool your children or some whatever, you know, sort of a mini school system. But you can usually find some creative approach to this problem. Values are extremely important. I don't know how to make it more important than what I've said so far. Okay. Now, there's also a numbers issue. Now, let's get into this. Economy, which is part of the seventh right, is dependent upon the numbers of individuals composed in the economy. The greater the number, the freer the economy, and the faster it grows, provided that there are no monopolies and there are no, or very few, outside controls coming from either government or some other kind of pseudo-governmental agency that interferes with people exercising their ability to be creative and to exercise their decisions of value. So as long as those things are open, the larger the economy, the stronger it becomes, because the variety of individual values evens out those that have distortions due to selfishness, and it moves usually closer towards the top, to the higher levels. When you move to a smaller and smaller economy, you have you have to maintain higher levels of freedom and less amounts of restriction for the society to remain enlightened. And sometimes, under rare circumstances, you can socially engineer such an economy for a short period of time, like 20 years, 40 years or so, using principles in socialism. If everybody wants the same thing, but you've got to have a lot of homogeneity in that kind of society. Almost everybody has the same background, the same values, and you could almost bet that's going to be only for a short time that it'll take place, because as those economies are successful, then they start falling apart because they start growing in numbers, and you don't have the homogeneity anymore. This has been achieved by some of the Scandinavian countries. They, when they were small enough, could socially engineer some elements of socialism in their economy, but as they grow, it starts to irritate people because it isn't universally applied that people are free anymore because they don't all think the same, etc. The more people are the same, the easier it is to do that, but the stronger society is like the United States, where you have the greatest level of diversity with the highest levels of freedom, except right now that isn't true with the present political climate, but normally, highest levels of freedom, and the least amount of interference by government, by restriction, with the most amount of people being as creative as possible and being able to make their own individual choices and to establish an economy with others in a free market. With all that going for it, the United States should be doing much better today than it is, but that's because we have moved dramatically towards a controlled economy. And the more you control it, the faster it's going to be destroyed. Okay, so the numbers are important because if you can get very large numbers, you can get some almost incredible leaps forward in all kinds of areas of development in civilization. Civilization is bringing in the lower kingdoms and using them in beneficial ways for them and for us, eventually, but some virtuously, so the world really tremendously develops. If you have a large number of people doing this in a free market system, you can get tremendous increases in very short periods of time in civilization. Society grows exponentially. But you have to maintain the elements of what I've said, and it's got to be done on a fairly conscious level because people tend to subconsciously want to control and want to stop others from doing their own thing. Okay, so why is it so hard to maintain this this large number since it's so good for us? Because of the impetus to force people into a certain mold by people with elitist and egotistical, arrogant viewpoints, and who think they have the either right or they have a lot of money to try to do it, and either want to do it through monopolistic systems in business, or they want to do it more likely in government. It's easier to do it from government than it is to do it from business. And so this is where it gets dicey, because then you say, well, what is one way around this? And the founders of the United States said, why don't we create states that have semi-autonomy, that fight against the government, the central government, and prevent some of this from happening, and then under the states, give power to townships and counties and towns and villages and cities and so on, so that each political entity has some way to thwart the overbearing nature of restriction. It sounds like a great plan, and it actually can work. But sometimes what has happened is you just have a compounding effect of each one of those sub-entities of politics actually becoming another dominant force in trying to control and to limit the amount of exchange and the amount of creativity, the amount of production, and eventually limit the values of people too, all coming from each one of these units trying to gain some level of power and control. And that's where the danger lies. Now, how do you overcome that? Well, here's the first thing. The first thing is that you do not allow any political entity to enter into the exercise of control over most of the parts of an economy. You have to separate that. You have to have virtually anti-socialism legislation and anti-governmental restriction legislation in place almost on a continual level. It needs to be revamped maybe every few years so that the creeping, which usually happens to try to limit and control, is undone and thrown out. You correct problems and abuses through laws, but you don't create restrictions on creation and development. And say certain values you're going to support and other values you're going to restrict is because you feel your values are more important than others. And that's, of course, what happens all the time. All the time. On school boards, almost every kind of government grant and government handout and government this, they all come attached with the values of the political government that is instituting it at the time. So I suggest that as part of our values, we reject the idea of receiving encouragement and support from the government for anything that involves our economy. I know it's a bitter pill because a lot of people say, what about all that stimulus the government can do? It's a fake stimulus. All it is the government by fiat deciding what's good and not good for us and then forcing us to do certain things that destroys our economy. Because economy doesn't come from everybody doing the same thing. It comes from everybody having different values and being creative in the way they exercise those values. So it's just a smoke and mirrors thing. It's something good is going to come out of it. Nothing good is going to come out of it. It's just going to be more and more destruction. If you haven't read Hayek's book, The Road to Serfdom, great, great book. Read that book about socialism. In 48, I think they sold like a half million copies over last year because Glenn Beck talked about it on his show when he was on TV. And he just sold the heck out of that book. Unbelievable. A book from 1948, a half million copies. It's pretty amazing. Okay, so the The point here is that if we're going to establish the value system that I'm suggesting, one of the values we need to have is we have to have extremely limited government. And if we don't value limited government, then the results are going to be disastrous, because government is the boogeyman. Now, government doesn't have to be just the federal government. It can be school boards. It can be, it can be the Planning and Zoning Commission. It can be a whole bunch of other types of things that have some business doing some things, but they have a lot of other things that they have no business doing, because they restrict the creative side. The more things you have to get permits for, the more things you... What does permit mean? Permission. The more things you've got to be approved of, and that you've got to pay for and wait for, the less economy that can exist. And the more people's values become the values of the system rather than their own. That's how the system takes us over. You're restricted to the point where the only values that count are the ones that are being fed to you through the system. You do it our way, you don't get it done at all. Well, then you can't create anything new. You see? If you can't create anything new, you can't create. And creation is the first part of God's mind. You take away that, you don't have God anymore. See how quickly you go onto a dark road by just having restrictions. That's all it takes. All right, what are some of the other things, because I don't want to get too mired down in this one element, what are some of the other things we have to be concerned about in trying to cooperate and share more? Well, the first thing is, if you really want to just focus in on cooperation and sharing, which is the highest level that the seventh rank exists within, you need to be faced with the issue that your needs are no more important than the needs of anyone else. Your needs are no more important than the needs of anyone else. That doesn't mean that you can't seek things for your own enjoyment, for your own life. But if you give the respect to everybody else, that they have the same rights, and that you support those rights in others, then the government won't be able to grab it away from them. Because you support it, and we collectively are the government in this country if we exercise that, which we haven't been doing very well. So you see how this could work if everybody said, well, everybody's needs are just as important as mine. That's a good place to start from. It doesn't mean I have to live in a way that I'm a soul yet, but at least if I had the thought that that guy's rights got to be respected just like mine, then it becomes very important. And if we see someone doing something crooked or corrupt, it becomes just incumbent on us to try to stop that, as it would be if they're doing it to us or anyone else, because we are all part of the system. The corruption of the system is what leads to the destruction of the system. And so we are all here to try to prevent that from happening. If you see evil, expose it. Bring it in the light. And if you don't know where there is evil, give me a call. I'll let you know. Seriously. There's a lot of evil around us, and most people don't know it. Because evil is so good at hiding itself. It's incredible. And there's a lot of corruption, which is certainly connected to evil. And it's everywhere. But in some places, it's worse than others. We can do something, provided we see that the needs of others are as important as ours. And just because the evil hasn't come into our household yet, or our neighborhood, doesn't mean it isn't going to if we don't stop it in someone else's. Right. Yeah, that's the way it is. Now, I know there's a lot of people who say, well, that you're just trying to be a do-gooder. If I live my life just because I want to see other people's needs being important as mine, then aren't you saying I'm supposed to be some kind of soul? No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying your needs are not unimportant. It's just that you recognize that other people have needs that they see just as important as you see yours. That's all. It's recognizing the importance of others. and that an economy cannot exist unless all people respect that in others. Otherwise, each person is going to be, like in the pastor situation, trying to take more than everybody else is taking, and you have a system of the dog-eat-dog thing, and it's evolutionary, and the survival of the fittest. Well, that's not God, and it's not human. And you're moving backwards in kingdoms to the animal kingdom. You're going to live like your life like an animal, and animals don't have the values that humans do. They value the things of immediate concern or things that they selfishly want to control, even for the future, and they do so usually through force and seldom through consciousness and wisdom. They live like animals live. They do live with the survival of the strongest, fittest, sometimes smartest, but not necessarily wisest. Humans, if they choose to live that way, lose the values that make us so special. We lose the value of creating more of God. And once you lose that, you lose the joy of life, the meaning of life, and you're on a path of self-destruction, depression, and meaninglessness. Now, I know most people don't want to have that going on. So be aware that what I'm suggesting here is not some kind of glorious kind of, oh, that's another utopian idea. No, this is a practical idea. It's practical to be concerned about the needs of others. Very practical. Now, let's go a step further. Should you be concerned about the needs of others by giving to them the things that they want and or need on a purely, we'll say, superficial level? No. When we give to others what they want or need on a superficial, meaning more material than spiritual level, the results are that they become dependent upon the giving. They lose their will or choices that are consistent to become something greater by growing themselves through the values they have, which would be more closer to God, and to co-creating with their Creator, to becoming just taking what they can get and living a subsistence at best life. That's the system of welfare. And that's what we don't want to do. We don't want to do that with our children. We don't want to do that with our friends. We don't want to do that with our enemies. We don't want to do that with anybody. People say, well, there's poor people out there. What are we going to do with them? What you do is you get them to learn the value of opportunity, and then you make sure they have those opportunities that would, by their own value system, cause them to become creators. But first, sometimes they need some remedial education and or help psychologically because they may have already been welfareized and somewhat destroyed in that will by a system that has gone awry. Can we do that? Sure. We did it about 16, 17 years ago. We redid welfare and we made people do some of the things I just said, get an education, psychological. And in 2 years, they had to get off welfare. If you know the system we did, and it worked. It really did. And now we have reinstituted welfare because the present people in power want those people to be voters for them by becoming dependent upon them. It's a monarchical system and highly communistic. And it's redistributive. We'll give you more provided you give us what we want, which is power and control. So you vote for us, and we'll give you a nice subsistence life getting welfare, not paying any taxes. About half the people are not paying taxes. Got to stop that. Why is it important people pay taxes? Well, it's important because they have more responsibility for what takes place in the government. They are paying for it, right? And they will want to take that responsibility and not have the system just giving them a free holiday away from taxes. But in the system of welfare, there also has to be the process of charity and the givingness of all. So another thing that we have to foster, which is part of our heritage, and this country is great for it, the United States is, if you're listening from this country, or if you're not, you probably know something about it, is we are the most charitable of all countries, on an average. That doesn't mean all of us are charitable. How do we encourage charity in people? Because that's another high value. Well, the best way to encourage charity is to expose to people on their level of values the system that is being destructive for those who need charity. So let's take the welfare system as we know it today. If people are exposed to the problems that others are having because they can't find a job, because they don't have proper skills, because they've been miseducated, if educated at all, and because they never had a good family life, then can we do something about that? Yes. The charity that we give them are not more food, shelter, and clothing, necessarily. They might need a little bit of that, at least in the very beginning. But we need to help them prepare to change their own values so that they can exchange themselves into the economy better and function more in the economy. Poor people aren't poor because they can't do anything. They're poor because they keep doing the wrong things, because their values are wrong. Their values are wrong because of the wrong education, the wrong family, the wrong, et cetera. That's why. So we help them in that process. We help grow them, and that's part of our charity to them. The givingness may be by maybe even just literally volunteering to teach them something about values, to help them see how higher values will really be better for them. And there are better ways to live. Maybe just the experience of seeing us do it, and it's working for us, will help. We segregate those people so far away from us, they may not even understand the simplest things that we already do. And it's getting worse. There's more and more of them every day. Our society is spiraling out of control in the wrong direction. These are all things that can be done. Every one of us can be doing these. There's other forms of charity besides just that, but I'm just giving you some ideas. The charity is not for just the other folks. It's for us. Charity raises our values. Why? Because charity is a form of giving that involves, if it's helpful, wisdom. By giving wisdom, or giving wisely, we get closer and closer to becoming our soul so that we can cooperate and share ourselves at greater and greater levels and enjoy an economy which is stronger and stronger based upon our creations, based upon better and better values within ourselves. Charity is one of those values. So charity isn't for just the people that we're giving wisely to. Charity is equally for us. You didn't know that? Well, I do. Some of you do, of course, know that. What else do we need? We need to have an optimistic attitude about improvement. The last thing we want is to believe that we are incapable of, or we have already passed the capability of, making right what has not been, and eventually reaching the point where we will be great soul-like and soul beings in some future. This has to be an understood place where we're moving towards, and we're going to get there. Every one of us will get there. Now, some not as quickly as others, but That's the first kind of approach. And that's the approach like, yeah, I'm going to get there. Now, I know it's going to be tough. I'll screw up occasionally. Sometimes I won't let myself down and I won't do the things that are really important. But I will eventually get there. And that's the key element. And not to be downtrodden. Don't listen to those in political authority who condemn us or tell us that we're no good or whatever. Just throw them out. Because the optimism is about the fact that this is the hardest place to be. And even if you haven't done the greatest, even if your values are not the highest, even if your economy of exchange is not the greatest, not the most wonderful, you're still here. You're still in the trenches. And we're all working together to make it better. So optimism is an element. And you get optimism by joining with others and discussing sometimes your failures and as well as sharing your successes so that others can help you with your failures and you can help them with your successes and we can collectively grow. And that gets us closer to the soul-like side, even though we're still functioning totally individualistic. By doing that sharing and working together for a common goal, the optimism grows with it. Very hard to be optimistic if you're sitting alone in a room, out of work, out of money, out of time, in ill health, and lonely without a sense of friendship. The best way to get out of that is get with others. Some who maybe have some similar problems, but others who have different ones. Because then the concept of economy and exchange comes in. At least your problems aren't the same as everybody else's. So some can help you while you can help them. Even though both of you, or all of you, have different problems, and some of them equally of severity, but not the same. That makes sense? Sure. And it's another part of the economic situation. And the reason you got different problems, actually, is because you got different values. Some things produce certain kinds of problems, and other kinds of values that are used selfishly produce different ones. So it's good that we are not all selfish in the same ways, such as in a communistic system where the reverse is true. You have a recipe for the worst kind of disaster, where everybody gets depressed in almost the same way. They all turn into alcoholics and just unbelievably depressed. What a terrible thing. That's the condemnation of an evil, dark society. Hopefully we're not moving. We're not going to go any further, at least towards that direction. I'm hoping we're moving in the right direction. Okay, and hope. Hope for a definite improvement in all this is worthwhile having. It comes with the optimism. And hope sometimes comes from just prayers for some people. Others, it's because they know God is with them, no matter how bad things are. And that is always a true statement. No matter how dark you have become, you can always turn to the light, and God will be there. Even evil people, the most evil of people, have that choice they can make. I'm not saying they will. It's a very difficult one for them because they've lost so much of their humanity in the process. And humanity is the ability to see God. So they've lost this ability to see God. They only see evil. And so they function with evil, within evil. And because so many of us are attuned to seeing God, we don't see the evil around us. So that helps evil out. But eventually you see evil because not because you are blinded by only you wanting to see God, but because you want to stop others from destroying God, which is destroying life itself. So that's another part of the equation, another part of the process that each of us can participate in and become in a kind of collegiate way with others, a proponent of a brighter future through God. Now, that may sound like a very religious thing. It is for some people. It's not for me particularly, but it is for some people. And however it means to you, it's okay to say to yourself, the real point to all this is to become a co-creator with my Creator. And no matter how bad things are, no matter what's going on here, no matter how much evil is surrounding me, I still have God. And that is a real tremendous help. It gives the greatest level of hope in the face of the most tragic and serious forms of evil and destruction. And it allows each of us to pull ourselves out of the most desperate of moments. But when we do it collectively, it gives us the greatest level of ability to not only pull ourselves out, but to help up everybody else as well at the same time. These are terrific, wonderful means of improving the nature of the seventh ray and moving it towards the virtue of cooperation and sharing as a means of life itself. The strangest thing of all is at the end of this process, literally changes us from this interim period of having to find ourselves lost at times in our own selfishness and fight against it, into becoming almost infinite creators without bounds, without restrictions, without having to fight governments or anything else, because nothing can stop us. We've become so powerful in the ability to co-serve with God. So those things no longer matter to us anymore. They can't stop us. They have no effect on us. Then that's where we're really truly headed for. This level is, granted, hundreds, thousands of years away. But there are planets. There are places, not Earth, that have achieved this, sacred planets. And they have none of the things that I've talked about us overcoming. They know about them from their past or from planets like Earth in studying us. But, and they may even have trouble fully comprehending what it's like to be like that, because it's been so long since they have. But nonetheless, they have been through it, and they've gotten to these greater levels. That's a great blessing for us. And the belief that we will get there is one of the greatest, I would say, handles to hold on. Not maybe as great as knowing God is with us, but knowing that others have managed to go through some of the things we're having here. Granted, this may be an extreme example. It may be worse than most planets, but certainly some planets have been as bad as Earth and made it. Maybe only a handful at this point in the universe, but still, that gives us a great perspective to say, hey, yeah, we can do it. I know it's tough. I know we're going to have to go through sacrifices and great challenges, but we can do it. And the physical existence is the greatest existence for us to challenge ourselves about this. So a lot of people say, well, why should I even stay alive? It's so bad here. It's so miserable. It's so physically intolerant. And the reason is because this is the opportunity, and it's a very short period of time, by the way, in the time we live, it's very short. This is the opportunity we have to challenge ourselves to the max. If we have that, it hurts like hell sometimes, and it's as miserable as it can ever be miserable. But without it, we would never have a true understanding of the limits, and our values would never be challenged to move so much higher. So it is critical that we go through this tough time in each lifetime. For most, 70, 80, 90 years, we go on and live hundreds of years in the astral world, and many more hundreds, up to 1,000 or more in the mental world. This is nothing. It's really nothing. Now, it's in those times, not our time here. So it's hard to understand. But the perspective is that we really live those times. Don't get confused by that. We really do live that time. It's just that it's dilated, and it's in a different perspective than our time here. And so this is the amazing thing about it. As hard as it is, it's almost in the blink of an eye in comparison to the rest of our life. And when we get to the other side, we're going to realize that. It's just that while we're here right now, it seems so terrible, like such a drudgery. And this is our opportunity now to grasp it and say, I'm going to do the best I can while I can, and I won't be back here for a while. But when I come back the next time, I'll be even better prepared. So why not do the very best that can be done now, instead of wait for another lifetime or 10 or 100? The faster we move, closer the whole race moves towards cooperation and sharing. And the issues that are so problematic today, the wars, the terrible consequences of the lives that are wasted, all that will diminish and eventually disappear. Well, we are definitely out of time. I want you all to consider the things I've said. As usual, I've done a little kind of preachy things at the end, but I do that, throw it in at the end. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.